Welcome back to What's at Risk. I'm Mike Christian.
I believe that you heard your master sing when I was sick in bed. And now do you come back to bring your prisoner wine and bread?
The very purpose of life is to seek happiness. If you ask the Dalai Lama if he's happy, his answer is an unqualified yes. The spiritual and temporal leader of Tibet, a tireless advocate of human rights and winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, the Dalai Lama always seems to be smiling and laughing, despite having suffered the devastating loss of his country, being confronted with the endless responsibilities of a world leader. Convinced that the Dalai Lama had learned to live with a degree of fulfillment and serenity that he had never seen in other people, the American psychiatrist Howard C. Cutler set out to discover the beliefs and practices that had helped him to achieve this and to bring these methods to a Western audience. That journey became The Art of Happiness, a beloved and best-selling text that has helped countless individuals of all backgrounds to overcome fear and cultivate true happiness in their own lives. Based on a series of extensive conversations that took place over a period of many years, The Art of Happiness takes on life's most vital questions. What is the purpose of life? What is the path to true happiness? How can one overcome suffering and loss? Accessible approach, the Dalai Lama teaches that the ultimate objective in life is to seek happiness, and that real and lasting happiness can be obtained not by bettering one's outward circumstances, by seeking wealth or power, the perfect mate or the perfect physique, but by training the mind through daily practice and dedication in much the same way you would train for any other skill. Scientific evidence has shown that the beneficial effects of happiness extend to the broadest level of society. Increasing the average level of happiness among the population of a nation will result in an increase in freedom and democracy in that country. A New York Times bestseller, which stayed on the list for 2 years, The Art of Happiness has sold well over 1 million copies and has been translated into 50 languages and become a venerated classic. Transcending borders to help readers face issues common to all human beings, the book has spread its message of compassion, unity, and inner peace to countless people around the world.
Oh, I dreamed about the Dalai Lama. He rode by a stream on his little fat pony. Dark jungle full of hungry tigers. And he turned to me as if to say, it's okay. He'd be there soon.
His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama is the spiritual and temporal leader of the Tibetan people. His tireless efforts on behalf of human rights and world peace have brought him international recognition. He is a recipient of the Wallenberg Award, the Albert Schweitzer Award, the U.S. Congressional Gold Medal, and the Nobel Peace Prize.
If sand waves were sound waves, what song would be in the air now?
Howard Cutler is a psychiatrist, best-selling author, and speaker. He is co-author with the Dalai Lama of the acclaimed Art of Happiness series of books.
We are speaking with Dr. Howard Cutler, the co-author with the Dalai Lama of the Art of Happiness. So maybe more from my perspective than anything, how did you happen to come to know the Dalai Lama?
I got a grant in 1982 from the medical school I was going to study traditional Tibetan medicine for a few months. And it turned out that the Dalai Lama's older brother was director of the Tibetan Medical Institute at that time. And I lived in the government guest house across the hall from the Dalai Lama's brother and his brother's family and so on. So it was actually through them that I first met the Dalai Lama. Just basically, they facilitated a meeting. I was just mostly curious to meet him. I had heard so much about him.
And in your conversations, which eventually ended up in the book, The Art of Happiness, did you initially set out to write a book, or did it evolve over time?
It evolved over time. It was actually around a 10-year period before I conceived of the idea of collaborating on a book with him about happiness. Of course, over the years, I was really impressed with his intelligence and sense of humor and kindness, and particularly impressed with I really felt that he had something to offer non-Buddhists as well as Buddhists in terms of strategies to achieve happiness. So eventually he came to visit Arizona, which is where I'm from, and I had an opportunity to spend a good chunk of time with him at the same time. You know, I met with him daily and so on. So having a block of time, which was one of the rate-limiting steps, I asked him about collaborating on a book, which sort of distilled the principles that he lives by, but that was geared for a general Western audience, ordinary people, not necessarily Buddhists, and that was framed from my perspective as a Western psychiatrist within the context of Western science and psychology, and also practical everyday stories on how to apply his principles. And he liked that idea because he's a big fan of Western science and also a big believer that people don't necessarily need to convert to Buddhism. In fact, he feels people should generally stick with their own religion. But he's really fond of talking about the level of what he often calls secular ethics, or sometimes calls basic human values, just the values of, you know, good, decent human kindness and tolerance and compassion and so on, which was the level that the book was written on. So that's what basically prompted the initial collaboration. And then the book eventually turned into a set, which is eventually going to consist of six volumes, simply because there are so many topics under the broad category of human happiness. We have a new book, The Art of Happiness in a Troubled World, coming out next week, too.
Following along that, I was going to say you're reissuing this book now, or it's another edition, 10-year anniversary edition. Was part of that prompted by the difficult times that we're going through right now? Because people certainly are probably grappling with finding happiness again.
Absolutely. Well, as far as the 10th anniversary edition goes, coincidentally, within a matter of months after the publication of The Art of Happiness, an entirely new branch of psychology was formally established called positive psychology, which is essentially the science of human happiness and positive emotions and thriving and so on. So because of that, there's been what some people refer to as a happiness revolution over the last decade, which has been not only tremendous interest among the general public, but an explosion of scientific research on happiness. So even though I tried to provide scientific evidence supporting his views in the original book, there's been a tremendous amount of research in the last 10 years, new research, that has consistently and invariably provided evidence supporting the views that were in the book, which at the time there was no scientific evidence for. So I thought it was a good time for an update as far as that goes. And then the new book, The Art of Happiness in a Troubled World, was prompted by our ongoing discussion over the years, which eventually expanded from the concept of inner development as the way to achieve happiness Of course, we retain that general principle, but taking a look at, okay, well, human beings don't live in a vacuum. We interact within a society. There's so many problems in the world today. How does the society and the world's problems impact our personal happiness, and what can we do about it, and so on. So that's what actually prompted The Art of Happiness in a Troubled World.
That will be a timely addition. Now, when the Dalai Lama says that happiness can be achieved by training the mind, what does he mean by that?
Basically, he means by taking a look at all the different mental states and emotional states that we experience on a day-to-day basis, which could include emotions like anger, jealousy, hatred, frustration, anxiety, but it could also include moments of kindness, compassion, affection, tolerance, forgiveness, and so on. So from his perspective as a Buddhist monk, and which has been now supported by more recent scientific evidence, the more positive emotions one experiences, the happier one is, and the less negative emotions one experiences, like hatred, anger, jealousy, fear, whatever, the happier one is. So training the mind essentially involves, in a systematic, deliberate way, through various techniques, cultivating these positive states of mind and working on reducing the negative states of mind. That's kind of what we mean by training the mind.
To open my eyes and wake up alive in the world. To open my eyes and finally
in Buddhism, at least from my perspective, is to ultimately become enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
How does that interact with the art of happiness in the way that you've described it in your book?
Well, in one conversation I had with the Dalai Lama, we were talking about happiness and so on, and he pointed out that, of course, there's many different levels of happiness, different types of happiness. From his perspective as a Buddhist monk, of course, the idea of enlightenment or liberation and so on is considered to be the highest form of happiness. But from the level that we were talking about in The Art of Happiness and the subsequent books, we're talking more about conventional day-to-day happiness, a feeling of well-being, fulfillment, satisfaction with one's life, that type of thing. We weren't talking about the ultimate happiness from the Buddhist perspective, which is enlightenment.
Do you feel our fundamental nature, our Buddha nature, if you will, that, as the Dalai Lama might say, is to be happy?
That's a good question. I know our fundamental nature is to strive for happiness, greater and greater happiness, and I think that each human being has the capacity to achieve genuine and lasting happiness. In terms of our nature, when you talk about Buddha nature, we can get into a little bit of a philosophical thing about the underlying nature of mind, which Buddhists feel is pure, that all the negative emotions like anger and hatred and jealousy is like if you have a glass of muddy water, the negative emotions are like the impurities in the water, which can be removed to reveal the underlying pure nature of the water. That's how they see the mind is ultimately the nature of mind is pure and not tainted by these negative emotions. But on a practical level, most of us are born with the propensity, certainly, and the tendency to experience negative emotions innately and naturally. We can reduce those and eliminate those, but it takes effort. So I wouldn't say that we were naturally born in a happy state to achieve that. If we're not talking about, you know, the ultimate philosophical levels, on a practical level to achieve that requires some effort.
In the context of the book, in terms of attaining the art of happiness, the Dalai Lama uses concepts like connectedness and compassion and service to others. How does he link those concepts to happiness?
Well, in fact, the very way that we think of happiness from the perspective or art of happiness approach is that personal happiness is inextricably linked with kindness, compassion, caring towards other people. And it's impossible to be genuinely happy, from our perspective, if one is just purely, you know, selfish and hostile and that type of thing. And in fact, that's been supported by the scientific research. When the original book came out, I mentioned some research showing that increasing one's level of happiness will increase one's willingness to help other people, it'll result in people being more charitable, altruistic, and so on. More recently, there's been research showing the converse, that the deliberate cultivation of kindness and compassion will increase one's happiness level in a very real and very practical way. In fact, they've done studies with brain scans in which they've generated kind of a state of compassion or feeling of compassion among subjects, and it just lit up the happiness area of the brain, which is in an area called the left prefrontal cortex. So there's been some very elegant evidence showing that link between happiness and compassion, and that's one of the fundamental principles of the art of happiness.
Yeah, I think I've read that people that are giving and helping all the time actually release endorphins, the same types of endorphins that you might get when you're out running or, you know, feeling particularly good. So it's actually a chemical release too.
Absolutely. When I do workshops or when I do individual training with people to increase their happiness levels, you know, one of the exercises that I recommend, which is based on a scientific study that was done by Sonia Lubomirsky at the University of California, Riverside, which is assign them to choose one day a week and perform 5 random acts of kindness. And after 5 or 6 weeks, you can measure through testing the increase in a person's happiness. So it's really effective.
Tell us about the process of change, because we're, you know, most of us, even though we talked a little bit before about our fundamental nature being happy, especially today, there's a lot of anxiety, there's job loss, there's so many different things that are happening that are coming to us that causes us to be more focused on ourselves and maybe not be in that state of happiness. What process, you know, just maybe some highlights, what will be steps in a process to change, to move more towards being happy?
Well, one of the main techniques that, you know, we use in the Art of Happiness, not just in the book, but that I use with individuals or groups, is basically learning how to change one's perspective on a negative situation or adverse event and so on by looking at it from a wider perspective or a different angle, so that rather than focus purely on the negative aspect of the situation that's causing us anxiety or depression or anger, we, in a very deliberate and systematic way, examine it to see, is there other ways of looking at this from the standpoint of potential positive outcomes or angles? Is there something that I could learn from this situation potentially? Could it help me grow in some way? If I'm angry at somebody and at that moment one's perspective narrows, so you see them as purely 100% evil, you know, somebody who's spending 24 hours a day just thinking of ways to make our life miserable, on a brain level, that's how we're sort of perceiving that person. So the practice involves deliberately trying to look at that person from other angles, looking at them as an ordinary human being, and everybody has positive and negative angles, looking at them from the possibility of, that person is a good parent, or maybe that person, you know, it might not be that they're thinking of us 24 hours a day and how to harm us and so on. So it's the idea of saying, how can I look at this situation differently? How can I perceive potential positive angles and so on? And once we get in the habit of doing that, it takes a little practice because it's hard at first. It can completely transform the way we deal with our problems and negative situations. It can be very effective.
What's it like being in the presence of the Dalai Lama?
It can be actually quite fun. He's really smart. He has a great sense of humor. He likes to laugh a lot. I would say down to earth. You know, when you talk to him, it's like within moments, you almost forget that he's the Dalai Lama. It's just like talking to another human being. And he has quite an ability to put people at ease and relate to people at that level. You kind of get a sense that, you know how when you talk to some people, you may sense that they're talking to you based on your position or your status or how much money you have or what they hope to get out of you or a million different things. When you're talking with him, you get the sense that he's listening to you, that he's relating to you just as one human being to another, which is a nice thing.
Every time I see that bumper sticker that says free Tibet, I always think, I can't. I don't know where Tibet is. I don't know who has them. For all I know, they deserve captivity. All right, I do know this. I think Tibet is like way far away. Yeah, if so, why are they advertising here? You know, like when I have a garage sale, you know where I put the signs? Near my house. I don't go all willy-nilly putting them in other countries.
In 2009, the Dalai Lama delivered one of his harshest attacks on the Chinese government, saying that the Chinese Communist Party had transformed Tibet into a hell on earth, and that the Chinese authorities regarded Tibetans as criminals deserving to be put to death. Today, the religion, culture, language, and identity, which successive generations of Tibetans have considered more precious than their lives, are nearing extinction, said the Dalai Lama, the spiritual leader of Tibetans.
The Queen of Lion took her bow, and then she turned to go. The Prince of Peace embraced the blue, and walked the night alone.
The furious tone of the speech may have been in reaction to a new clampdown by China on the Tibetan regions. The Dalai Lama may have also adopted an angry approach to placate younger Tibetans who have accused him of being too conciliatory toward China. He advocates genuine autonomy for Tibet and not secession, while more radical Tibetans are urging him to support outright independence. The Chinese government has accused the Dalai Lama of fomenting separatist violence. He says he is pushing only for autonomous powers that are outlined in the Chinese Constitution. In his speech, the Dalai Lama reiterated that such autonomy had been promised to Tibet by Mao and other senior Chinese leaders whom he met in Beijing in 1954 and 55. The Dalai Lama began negotiations over the future of Tibet after Chinese troops invaded the Tibetan plateau and seized full control of Tibet in 1951.
Was good and bad, but mortals never know.
Despite the promises from Mao, he said, the Chinese government carried out a series of repressive and violent campaigns through the decades, including what the Chinese called patriotic re-education and strike-hard campaigns after the protests last year. These thrust Tibetans into such depths of suffering and hardship that they literally experienced hell on earth, the Dalai Lama said. China has defended its policies in Tibet by saying that it abolished a feudal slave-holding system overseen by the Dalai Lama and poured vast sums of money into building roads, railroads, and other infrastructure projects. Despite his harsh words, the Dalai Lama reaffirmed his commitment to trying to maintain a dialogue with China. We're back with Dr. Howard Cutler, co-author of The Art of Happiness.
How does he deal with the Tibetan situation today?
Oh man, that's a tough question.
I don't mean to have it be such a broad question, but I know that there have been, you know, changes in Tibet, and maybe some of the people in Tibet feel that he's been too passive or hasn't been aggressive enough for
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely.
You know,
yeah, I mean,
how does he view that?
You know, for 50, 60 years, he's been making a continuous effort to try to get greater autonomy for his people and religious freedom and preserve their culture and way of life. And the fact is that he's failed. I met with him last year in November, and last year was a particularly tough year because there were protests in Tibet and levels of violence and hadn't been seen for 20 years. And I could tell for the first time, I think ever, that I remembered in a long time, I could really sense his level of frustration and disappointment at the lack of progress. And in fact, he did end up calling for a forum among the Tibetan refugee community to discuss his approach, which he calls the middle way approach, to, you know, remain within China and yet have greater autonomy for his people, and to sort of have a consensus on his approach, because, quite frankly, he was sort of at a loss where else to go from here because he hasn't been successful.
And the dynamics there have become so much more complex in recent years.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Cutler, anything we missed? Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think you had some good questions. I guess if people have more questions or something, they can always go to my website. Is that okay to mention?
Please do.
Theartofhappiness.com. And in addition to this 10th anniversary edition that has some, you know, updated material, next week the third volume of the series called The Art of Happiness in a Troubled World is coming out, so I'm kind of excited about that. But other than that, you had some great questions.
Thanks. We've been speaking with Dr. Howard Cutler, the co-author with the Dalai Lama of The Art of Happiness. Thank you so much.
That's it for this week's edition of What's at Risk. I'd like to thank our very special guest tonight, Duane Evans, the author of North from Calcutta, and Dr. Howard Cutler, co-author with the Dalai Lama of The Art of Happiness. I'd like to thank our producer, Johnny Pfister of Ringo Studio, and our associate producer, Scott Cooper. Let us know what you're thinking about by sending us an email at whatsatrisk@risk-strategies.com. Tell us what's on your mind.
Podcasts of What's at Risk are available at the WBZ.com on the air drop-down menu by clicking on What's at Risk. You've been listening to What's at Risk, heard every Saturday night on WBZ News Radio 1030. And streaming on WBZ.com.
Run the risk.